Elizabeth had to catch up with everyone, and I didn't. So she considered who to leave me with. I was too used to this from Julian to mind. "I'll give you to Tony Eng," she decided. "He was at Woodham, so he tries not to act rich now." Edith looked over at Tony's red chinos, as though to tell me I could judge for myself his success in this.
"Ling Ling, you're glowing," Tony said. "How's Sam?"
"We broke up," Edith said.
"Wow," Tony said. "It's been eons."
"Definite eons," Edith said. With a clarity I blamed on alcohol, I knew precisely what I felt. Envy. It was partly that Edith's friends were rich, but mainly that she had them. The Sam thing I would get to later. "This is Ava," Edith told Tony. "Ava's single."
"Me too," Tony said. "Let's see which of us gets a man first."
I could reply, "Or a woman." But I didn't know if Edith had introduced me to Tony, thinking it might prompt my disclosure, or if the possibility had never occurred to her. The girls at school had claimed to want a gay best friend, despite not being someone any gay would want to be friends with. They still called me all sorts of things for not kissing enough boys. Edith and Tony had changed the subject now, so I nodded and made engaged expressions. I saw I hadn't just been holding back from coming out to Edith as part of some game. I also feared that she'd stop being friends with me. I thought that about Julian too, and about anyone in my life who had ever remotely cared about me. But I'd never had to confront it in Hong Kong because I hadn't had a crush on a woman till now. Or maybe I didn't care about coming out and just didn't want her to know that I was into her specifically. It was impossible to separate these issues. I couldn't like Edith without liking women, and I also felt, illogically but with conviction, that I couldn't like women without liking Edith. And I had that thought mid-laugh, so I had to keep laughing, or Edith would see what I'd been thinking. That night at home, I searched Edith's friend list online. There were 6 Sams, 4 male, 2 female. I clicked See Friendship between Edith and me, then went to the URL and edited my account name to each of the Sams in turn so it showed their history with her. 3 of them, 2 men, 1 woman, had nothing but birthday wall posts. 1 was only tagged with Edith in group pictures from Cambridge. The last pair, he Sam and she Sam, each had a single photo with their arm around her.
Chapter 26. I turned 23 on the 18th of May. The other teachers asked me along to the pub, but I said, truthfully, that I had plans. I'd asked Edith out for once and hadn't told her it was my birthday. I was embarrassed by the idea that she'd think I thought we were closer friends than we were. She texted me a balloon emoticon on the morning, which made me wonder if she'd known all along what day it was, or if she'd just got a notification about it. We met at a whiskey bar on Hollywood Road. Edith's present to me was a printed scarf by an LA-based eco-feminist collective. I was skeptical of its claimed carbon neutrality when it had been shipped from California to Hong Kong, but it was soft against my neck and it was wrapped, which suggested she'd known it was my birthday. We went inside. The place was crowded. The menu asked, "Would you make a pact with heaven for the finest drink on earth?" Edith found the Irish section and ordered me a Connemara peated single malt. "Shipped from the old country," I said. "Bring a tear to the eye, so it would." When it arrived, it was so strong, it actually did. She said I was a baby and then shuddered herself when she tried it. Julian had called me that once, a baby, and I felt this proved that words took their meaning from context. Next, we had cider. Mid-gesticulation, I knocked my glass over and spilled some on my lap. She took out pocket tissues. I thought she'd hand me one, but she leaned over and dabbed my thigh. Her hair smelled of smoke from the walk through LKF. Edith addressed the waiter in English, but he answered in Cantonese. "He guessed right," she said after he'd gone away. "But what if I were a Beijinger or Korean or something. Maybe he doesn't speak English? I said. It was a stupid comment, but I wanted to distract myself from her pout. It was another of my favourite Edith expressions, though I knew there was limited point in recording them when I could not imagine a single expression of Edith's which did not rank among my favourites. The best wedges of words were the ones my 8-year-olds wrote. I like her face. With her, I am happy. I wished I'd never learned more advanced grammar and could only make sentences like that. It would give me an excuse to say them aloud. You're not noticing because you're white, Edith said. People see me and assume I'm from here. But you are from here. Kind of, she said. But you miss things when you spend your teens abroad. It sounded like something a therapist might have told her. Oddly phrased to squeeze developmental insight into not very many words. She added that many people, her parents included, had a misplaced nostalgia for the British Empire because at least it wasn't China. Hong Kong is the one place where the late 20th century rebrand has worked, she said. We both found it hilarious that Brits thought their international image was one of flaccid, tea-loving Hugh Grantish butter-fingery. If they'd been a bit more indirect during the Opium Wars, or a bit more self-effacing on Bloody Sunday, then our countries would have been most appreciative. That's why they can't accept that they did colonialism, Edith said. They see themselves as people who can't even get a dog put down. We agreed also that the British obsession with dogs was creepy, both because of the volume of other animals they ate and in light of their historic and contemporary level of regard for humans. We talked fast together. I was always slowing down in Hong Kong, either to help the kids understand me or because Julian said everything at leisure, and I felt I should stay in rank. Only with Edith could my mouth get ahead of me. The other mercy was that in the thick of assertion, I could pretend not to notice her knee against mine. We did shots, then went down to Aberdeen Street to the pier. It was too late to get a decent view, but she said she liked watching the boats and imagining their shapes by drawing lines between the lights like a join the dots. Our walk started with ignoring everyone around us and ended with no one to ignore. You know, Edith said, it used to be illegal for locals to live on the peak. I'm not sure about mid-levels, but definitely the peak. Why? I said. Who lived there? She laughed. The British, of course. I wanted her to give me one of her spiels with her gestures like bodily extensions of her facts, but she left it there. It was 9 p.m. The office buildings sported a few dark windows like punched-out options on a game show, but plenty still burned bright. I pictured 1,000 Ediths and Julians hunched over tables, hitting targets, making waves, spitting out productivity. In front of us, though, the water held still. I wonder if there's a time in Hong Kong when not a single person is working, I said. Edith turned to me slowly. I hate my job, she said. I work hard, it's good to work hard, but I hate it. I just want Mrs. Zhang to be proud of me, which is stupid, because the things she values aren't the things I value, but she's my mum. I care what she thinks. Just tell yourself you're doing it ironically, I said. Do people still say that? Edith said. I cast for sincerity. I like girls, I said. Then, I like you. She kissed me. Chapter 27. We texted throughout the following week. I did it at work or while walking around shopping malls. I tried to wait 15 minutes. I'd write in the notepad app to stop her from seeing me type, count the seconds, then cut, paste, and send. But I soon found once I'd written something, I needed to show her right away. Among these messages, so, do you want to get coffee or something? The 3 elliptic minutes watching her type had a gravitational field all their own. She did not want to get coffee or something, or anything. The kiss, you see, was done in pastiche. Why was she taking this long to say no? Just say it and leave me for the worms to find. Then, yes, I'd like that. We got speciality coffees in Shengwan and laughed as we drank them. Mine was charcoal with cashew milk, and hers was bright pink dragon fruit. I considered asking if this made me the man, but decided ironic heteronormativity was still heteronormative, and also that it was too early to make that joke. I wondered which was better, a first date after 3 months of knowing someone, or moving into their apartment after 3, but still being friends with them half a year later. Neither seemed wildly successful, but I was too happy about Edith to mind. I couldn't focus at work. I would sit correcting papers, then think of her and cross my legs tighter together. In class, the children asked me what words meant or whether a spelling was correct. Instead of making them use a dictionary like I was meant to, I just told them the answer. It was fine. They had smartphones. Through the walls, I heard the other teachers giving stern instructions and wondered if my problem was that I didn't want to teach like they did, or that I didn't want to be a teacher at all. I hated being in charge. I wanted Edith to tell me what we were and how it worked. Whenever Julian did that, I hadn't liked the answer. It struck me now that maybe I could have, for instance, told him that with words, instead of pretending to be okay with it. Then I felt glad to have a new chance. I'd lied to Edith too, but not as consistently, and not about how I felt. My favourite students were the girls with neat copybooks. I knew they'd grow up to be like Edith, and was glad Hong Kong had a long-term supply. Connie Jian kept glue and a small pair of scissors in her pencil case. She cut out choice paragraphs from my handouts and stuck them in her notepad. "I like your notebooks," I told her. Then I wondered if I should have said it more bossily to make it clear that I was not trying, ever, to be anyone's pal. Connie considered, then accepted my praise. "I like them," she said. "No, too," perhaps to show her judgment was independent of mine. This also seemed like something Edith would do. No student had ever reminded me of Julian. Despite my speculations about his background, I'd never been able to picture him as an actual child. He didn't want me to see him any other way than how he was now. He liked me because I didn't know him before he was on a 6-figure salary. I asked Edith over to the flat a week after our first date. Unusually, she wore jeans and a cable-knit jumper. She presented me with a diamond-patterned crystal bowl for the coffee table and said to fill it with fruit or flowers. At face value, it was obviously a gift for me. But the fact that Edith had handpicked it for Julian's apartment made me uncertain what to say. Were we grateful, or just me? We ate fruit and watched an old film with Judy Garland. I wondered if other people watched movies when they asked someone around to do that, or if our actually doing it meant things were going horribly wrong. "I find Judy's brow intriguing," said Edith. "It's owlish." We were less taken with the plot. Judy was a dowdy farmer whose wayfaring actress sister set up camp in her barn to rehearse jaunty musical numbers with her troupe. There was a predictable dalliance with the sister's dashing fiancé, but we forgave him for being formulaic because he was played by Gene Kelly. Had the technology existed, I was sure Gene would not have got this far into a movie when he asked a woman around to watch one. "Do you think she's pretty?" said Edith. "Judy? Of course." Edith could have meant, "of course, because who else could I possibly find attractive?" or, "of course, because Judy, as both an LGBT icon and person of a gender I'd broadly said I liked, was a woman I was especially likely to have opinions on." "I see where you're coming from about the owlish brow," I said. "And she's got a good profile on her. She and Jean have a great pair of noses." There were better things I could have said. I regretted involving Jean, who really had no stake in this. But she kissed me anyway. "Judy's great," she said. "The studio made her wear prosthetics on her nose, you know. But I don't think she has them on here. She put her foot down in the end." I wish she wouldn't kiss me and then go off about Judy Garland's prosthetic nose. I told you, it's not prosthetic, it's her actual one. Look, I said. We started kissing again, and I forgot what I'd wanted her to consider. There was a Pavlovian moment where I started leading her towards Julian's room, but I stopped and brought her to mine instead. We went down on each other. She grabbed at my hair and said, yes, right there. Afterwards, we compared our bodies, and I realized that I had never actually felt calm doing it before. Now I could relax. Our limbs didn't seem to belong to either of us in particular. Edith had longer arms, we agreed. I'm so happy, I said. Me too, she said. I asked if the taste was all right. I'd always wanted to ask Julian, but knew what he'd say. Fine, which would make me worry more, or
like Pinot Noir, but I'm not sure if that's because you've had some or I have.
Edith said she couldn't describe it. I found myself breathing artificially slowly, as though to placate someone else, and realized it wasn't the answer I was interested in. It was being able to say I felt anxious. She had to go. Her parents expected her home. I told myself this had nothing to do with my question potentially being weird, then recollected that if she'd said something odd, then I would almost certainly wait a bit and say other things before leaving. There was no record of what had happened. I couldn't fully believe in it when it hadn't been committed to paper. Maybe that was why Sappho wrote poems. But when she died, they wrapped her papyrus around corpses to keep maggots off. It was fortunate Edith had left before I'd started waxing existential. I told myself, this is why you're single. This is how you can be having sex with two people, tell neither about the other, be living with one of them, and still be single. Chapter 28. June. At the start of June, my 9-year-olds finished regular plural and compound nouns and moved on to collectives. A flock of sheep. A clutch of eggs. A shower of wankers. The latter I kept to myself, but I did wonder what the English said, because it couldn't be a shower of. But as a fundamentally onanistic nation, they surely had some way to cluster it. I thought about how to ask Edith and make it funny as opposed to weird. And then Kendrick Yang asked what you said for grapes, and I lost my train of thought. Bunch, I said. No, cluster. And then I doubted myself again. He'd already written cluster, so I left it there. Sometimes I wondered if I was actually a native English speaker. As a kid, I daydreamed about having been secretly adopted from a foreign country. Russia was the leading candidate since I'd read a historical novel about a family fleeing the October Revolution. Though I knew if I revisited the book now, I would think it had terrible politics. Books about people who lost their money, or had none and got some, appealed more to my childhood imagination than ones where everyone stayed put, though that was far more common in real life. And characters who didn't consider class at all were boring. I couldn't believe those people existed. Everyone in school knew who had the biggest houses and whose parents were barristers. I'd once explained On the Scratcher and In the Scratcher to Julian, and asked if he thought there was something about the Irish character discernible from the near indistinguishability of drawing the dole and going to bed with someone. He'd been sleepy and hadn't said much. I wondered if I could nab this observation and see what Edith made of it, but knew I'd feel wrong. I wasn't sure, though, if the guilt would be for repeating something Julian thought I'd only say to him, or for tendering Edith old rope. It was Julian's 4th month away now. I felt on some level like he'd never come back. Edith and I kept having sex. There was only one feeling better than being chosen by someone so perfect, and that was having her utter the sentence, "I want you to finger me." Most people had crevices of soft skin, behind ears, wrists under sleeves, but all of Edith's felt like that. She was so small, it felt comically unnecessary to hold her close. We'd wrap around each other and laugh at how much bed we had left. I saw myself telling people, "We always make room for each other, for you see, we are compact." Then I remembered that I'd just spent half a year having quite a lot of sex with a vertically bothersome man. It was all very interesting. When Edith wasn't busy working, we'd lie in my bed, sharing secrets. After 3 weeks of this, she said she'd always been exclusively into girls, but it took her until Cambridge to realize not all women were, and that this made her gay. I asked if she'd ever tell her family. No, she said instantly. I claimed I'd tell mine if I ended up with a woman. Until then, there was no need to apprise them of my sex life. Not that it's all about sex, I said, but that's what they'd boil it down to. Edith agreed. 90% of why she couldn't tell her parents was the sex thing. I'd never slept with a woman before, though I'd spent most of my teens and college years obsessed with one or another. They'd all had boyfriends or girlfriends, or else they were just patently not someone who would ever fancy me. When I told Edith this, she asked if I thought I'd gone for unavailable people because I knew I'd never have to face the reality that being with them would not solve all my problems. I told her she had no business saying something that perceptive. Everyone does that, Ava, she said. You keep describing yourself as this uniquely damaged person when a lot of it is completely normal. I think you want to feel special, which is fair, who doesn't? But you won't allow yourself to feel special in a good way. So you tell yourself you're especially bad. I asked her again to stop reading me so well, and she laughed and said, Fine, I tried. But really, I liked when she psychoanalyzed me. Her air of knowledgeable objectivity reassured me that someone had the situation, me, in hand. She'd had sex before with her ex at Cambridge. Sam, she said. It was easier then. Their whole circle was LGBT. She'd edged back into the closet since returning to Hong Kong. Sam, I repeated, to show it was new information. We were too self-conscious to kiss in public. The first time had been permissible because it was spontaneous. But once it became a pattern, we worried people would notice. Small gestures took on significance. I'd nudge her on the arm and look at something on my phone. We went back to Central Pier and took a selfie, and I sent her it with the caption, Just gals being pals. I put a picture of Edith on my Instagram story, and when I saw that Julian had seen it, I felt a twinge that I thought at first was fear, but which I realized was more like excitement. Neither of them had all my secrets. At work, I pretended I was her, or that she was watching me. When the children whispered or watched videos on their phones, instead of ignoring it like I usually did, I coughed the way I knew Edith would. It worked. They stopped. When Clarice Shu asked me for help, I told her she was doing great. I didn't usually think of myself as someone who could dispense compliments freely. They wouldn't interest anyone. But you didn't need to be that great for a 10-year-old to want your approval. And it helped that I had the blackboard markers and they didn't. Sometimes, Edith came to meet me after work at the train station nearby. I was allowed to touch her then. We could stand on an escalator and I could reach out and do it. It was a normal thing for friends to do. I wanted people to know we were together, but only the ones who wouldn't hurt us for it. I'd have felt afraid to in Dublin, and I did in Hong Kong too. I wanted to explain that to Edith, that holding Julian's hand was like holding a museum pass, and holding hers was like holding a grenade. But that didn't make sense even in my head, so I knew it wouldn't if I tried to say it aloud. And she didn't want to hold hands either, so it never came up. I saw Miles again in June. He told me about the future communist leader, Zhao Enlai, hiding from machine gun fire and bayonets at the Western Astor House Hotel in Guangzhou. To blend in, Zhao and his wife wore, respectively, a three-piece suit and a silk Chi Pao dress. The anti-communist General Chiang knew they were there, but most likely let them go to repay the time Zhao had saved him from violent leftists. I felt it would have been a better story if I'd known more about the figures involved. Miles also told me about Julian's birth, then about when he'd met Florence. She'd had a smart pencil skirt on and said she worked at the Bank of England. He'd asked if she was a secretary and she'd said no, that she was a policy advisor and was saving up to do a PhD.
"You must forgive me," said Miles. "Those were different times. She forgave me at any rate."
He looked like he wanted to add that she did hold plenty of other grudges. Since I'd started visiting when Julian left, Miles seemed to be dropping in more snippets of their family life. It felt unfair that this was happening only now that my top priority was not finding out more about Julian. We listened to one of Nina Simone's 1976 Montreux recordings. "I wish I knew how it would feel to be free." Miles said it had been a 60s civil rights anthem in the US. Nina sang, "I wish I could say all the things I can say when I'm relaxed." It was no good trying to finish writing his book at the moment, Miles said. Instead, he was trying to devote more attention to his undergrads. There'd been a lot of students in the umbrella protests a few years ago, and that kind of thing was needed more and more. "So you want to brainwash your class?" I said.
"Yes, while I still can."
"My 8-year-olds are mad into conspiracy theories. Do you want to go with them?" Nina sang, "Jonathan Livingston Seagull ain't got nothing on me." I looked at my watch and counted 15 minutes without thinking about Edith, a personal record. Obviously, though, this set me off again. Miles had asked what I'd been up to, and I hadn't known what to say, because I'd been spending all my time with Edith. I didn't mind Miles knowing, but if I told him about Edith, then Julian might find out. If he found out about Edith, maybe Edith would find out about him. Then she'd want to know why I'd been lying. I lied to everyone about everything would probably not satisfy her as an answer. Chapter 29. In mid-June, Edith said we'd get boring. "As people," she said. A qualification I later analysed stringently. If we just had sex all the time. I said I disagreed, but that we could go on dates if it made her happy. "It does," Edith said. I was still so unused to her candour that it threw me into admitting I like dating too. "A lot of people do," she said. I said I pitied anyone who didn't. We got street food and bed on horses at Happy Valley. She took me for bubble tea on a long hilly street packed with convenience stores and made fun of how long I took choosing and then of my choice. If you hadn't rushed me, I might have chosen better. Anyone who picks matcha love potion in any allotted time period is a threat to public safety. We tried, and failed, but importantly tried, to get me over my fear of heights on the Hong Kong observation wheel and the Lantau Island cable car up over the mountains. On both, I screamed and grabbed Edith's hand, realised it was a couple-y thing to do, and wondered if other people did couple-y things and then questioned their own sincerity. But even if everyone else did the same things Edith and I did on dates, I decided it was still special for us. One day we went to Manmo Temple to make a wish. Incense smoked from ceiling coils. We stood at the urn, round and gold like a chalice, and I asked Edith what I wanted.
"You tell me," she said.
I laughed and kissed her cheek. The last week of June, Edith asked when Julian would return. "I don't know," I said. "He's vague." We'd just been shopping. Julian had told me I could get more throws after I said I liked the one in my room. I'd bought 4 with Edith, 2 in herringbone and 2 in windowpane, and was arranging them in the sitting room. Edith hadn't said much about my choices, causing me to suspect that she hated them and that Julian would too when he got back. It was unfair that they both had better taste than me. I added, "Do you think the throws are boring?"
"Vague how?" Edith said. "The throws are fine."
It was all on stolen time and I'd pay later. I knew that. My temple wish had been for Julian to come back and for it all to be fine. But I couldn't imagine it with any precision. I'd close my eyes and see him greet her, and that was as far as I could get. Whenever Edith was busy, I went out and walked my circuits of convenience stores and shopping malls, or I stayed in bed doing nothing. I wasn't lonely. My job was non-stop human contact, so I appreciated the time alone. But I couldn't quite relax. That night, I messaged Julian. I miss you. This was a strange thing to do. I wanted to improve my handwriting so I could set a better example for my students. I found a French cursive font online, then wrote out sentences containing every letter of the alphabet. The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. Pack my box with 5 dozen liquor jugs. Amazingly few discotheques provide jukeboxes. This seemed like a punishment, though I wasn't sure what for. After exhausting my supply of pangrams, I copied out Shakespeare sonnets. While we were watching a movie in bed, Edith saw one of my transcriptions in a notebook on my bedside table. She said I had lovely handwriting. I felt bad for accepting the compliment, like the letters on the page weren't really mine. That week, my 10-year-olds did if and whether. I'd known that in French you needed to use similar words when you turned a question into a noun clause, but Dubliners didn't always bother. We often said, I dunno, will he come back? Which was bad English. You were meant to say, I don't know whether he'll come back, or I don't know if he will. I underlined the conjunctions in the example sentences, then set the kids to work. A few finished early and chatted in Cantonese. I pretended not to notice. Ollie from Melbourne came in to borrow a whiteboard marker. We talked while the children wrote. In his most pedagogical voice, Ollie told me conjunctions were tricky buggers. There was a knack to them, he said, hooking his hand as though the knack was floating and he'd undertaken to catch it for me. Julian hadn't replied to my I miss you. I wondered if I really did, or if I'd wanted to feel powerful by claiming something about myself that wasn't true and which would trick him into thinking he had the upper hand. I didn't do things like that with Edith. It wasn't that I was more authentically myself around her. Manipulation was a part of my character, or I wouldn't do it. But Edith didn't bring it out, and Julian did. I didn't like who I was around him, but I felt I had to be that person sometimes because they were bad and I was bad. You keep yourself to yourself, Ava, Ollie said. It was apropos of something, but I'd tuned out. I said I had a lot on my mind. Finally, Julian replied to the message about missing him. He'd taken so long I'd nearly forgotten I'd sent it.
Sorry, busy at work. Miss you too.
I felt disloyal to Edith when it made me smile, then to Julian, because it was the kind of text Edith sent every day, and I still appreciated it more from her than from him. This contravened all economics. Assuming my demand for nice messages was elastic, when they were scarcer, it should surely drive up their value. But coming from Edith, they commanded a premium. Edith and I talked a lot during sex. Julian had never been verbal in bed, which had made it embarrassing when I was, like I'd misunderstood what we were trying to do. With Edith, speech was part of it. Slipping, getting words out till we couldn't. She said, keep going, we've got ages. When we finished, I said that was weird, and also a little depressing, like, let's not hold back sexually, since we're still relatively far from our anticipated time of death. Edith said, A, she'd meant the last train wasn't for a few hours, and B, if we were going to start calling each other out on bizarre coital utterances, then let's not even. We continued to hold Judy Garland in the esteem which was her due. I found a picture of her in her 50s, Edith said. We were right about the Stygian brow. She looks unflappable. Not in a placid way. In like a tough old broad way. That chimes with her personal history. We should visit her grave, Edith said. You're always so morbid after we have sex, I said. I can't help drawing inferences. My always had no business describing something we'd only been doing a few weeks. I saw Edith register and approve of its reifying effect. Sometimes I'd imagine her at Cambridge. I didn't know why I did that. My dinner with Florence reveries were probably not the sort of thing happy people thought about, but at least served an obvious purpose. The Cambridge thing didn't. But I liked seeing Edith's dark hair against the snow, or the stairs she'd climb in stone towers to get to tutorials. I thought about her life in Hong Kong, too. The Zhangs ate big dinners on national holidays, and the law firm I could reconstruct from its similarities to Julian's bank. I'd never seen the bank either, but had asked him to describe it. Maybe I was living through Edith. When I planted her in high-flying venues, it was because I couldn't sew myself there, and she was the next best thing. Vicarious aspiration couldn't quite explain why I was hooked on her life, but I didn't know myself well enough to get any closer. I found it scary in Ireland, I told her in my bed, having sex with men. I was really telling her that I miss you meant more from her than from Julian. It was not a link she could humanly be expected to make, which was why I could say it. Chapter 30. The last Sunday of June, we bought salads in Marks and Spencer and took the bus to Tai Pak Beach at Discovery Bay. I liked getting the minibus with Edith. It was green and white and jostled us violently. Even Edith dropped her sunglasses when it turned a corner. One evening, there was no button and we had to shout at the driver to stop. Edith practiced the Cantonese with me. Bus yi zhao ngoi. Then made me call it out and laughed when I got the tones wrong. It was hot on the beach. Three old ladies sat near us in fold-out deck chairs with a parasol propped in the middle. I asked Edith what they were talking about, and she said they were speaking Hakka, so she couldn't make much out. Edith's maternal grandmother spoke only Hakka and maintained she didn't need any other language in Hong Kong. There were some unfortunates who didn't speak it. Indeed, a great many, and perhaps more of them than one would like. But Mrs. Tan doubted it would improve their lot one whit if she dragged herself down to their level. Basically, Edith said, my gran is the Hakka version of a British expat. I knew I'd later repackage that comment as my own and sent it to Julian. Keeping up with both of them took work, but their similarities lent the enterprise a certain economy of scale. Not only could I re-gift my own observations to both of them, they enjoyed each other's without realizing who had stolen them from. Edith asked me to teach her Irish. When she repeated the phrases, she didn't say them with her usual accent, but with a sinophone intonation. She said maybe it didn't matter how many languages you learnt, you always brought the flavor of your first. Anyway, in 50 years we'll be speaking Mandarin, I said, if you believe Julian. He says most of the clients are mainlanders now. Why have they kept him on? He's very tall. Edith said he sounded like a guy from her firm she went running with. He was an overpronating arsehole, she said. Overpronating was when your foot moved too far inward as it landed on the ground. Arsehole was when you had a personality like his. So why do you run with him? I said. He's on my team at work. So it's that or drink beer with him. Edith could make most words sound cutting, and beer was one such word. Do you think he has a crush on you? I said. Men never fancy me, she said complacently. I think Julian might when he gets back. I'll have to warn him you're a lesbian. Have I shown you his ex? We looked at pictures of Kat. The screen glared in the sun. Edith said Kat was gorgeous, and questioned how on earth Julian had convinced her to go out with him. But I don't know him, so I shouldn't be uncharitable, she added, not necessarily in a tone of regret. Then Edith asked if I thought I'd ever leave Hong Kong. The Hakka ladies were watching, so I just stroked her hand. We could leave together, I said. London has law firms. I've heard there's a hiring freeze coming, Brexit and all that. And why London? I don't know. It seems livable. Because it's away from your family? Probably. I think you like your space, Edith said. I couldn't say everyone in Dublin hated me, such that I came to hate myself too, and I came out here trying to change that, and it's kind of worked, but not fully. I didn't think Edith would get it. I also wasn't sure if it was even true about everyone hating me. It had felt that way, but maybe it did for everyone at that age. She went back to a document on her iPad, and I considered what I'd said about us leaving together. It had just come out. I'd never really given it much thought. I could barely think about what might happen whenever Julian came back, let alone afterwards. But I could see us living somewhere very tidy, and neither of our families ever finding out. The worst thing would be being out to hers, but not to mine. It would give her more power. She'd be able to talk to them about me. Then I felt like a horrible person for wanting her relationship with her parents to be as secretive as mine, just because it would keep us even. I wondered if other people had to consciously expel thoughts like that, or if they just never had them in the first place. But it was presumptuous to think about any of that. Probably I was jinxing the whole thing. That night in Julian's apartment, I said, "Is it true there are loads of lesbians at boarding school?" "If there are, they don't come out," said Edith. "The teachers were worried there wasn't enough compulsory heterosexuality, so they made us do socials with Eton." I was about to say she might have bumped into Julian, then remembered he'd have started at Oxford by the time she came to the UK. "No one was out in my year either," I said. "You'd have got a door slammed on you." She looked at me like she didn't know if I was joking. I wasn't sure either. There were reasons besides men I'd been unhappy in Dublin. Next morning, we walked in Sun Yat-sen Park. Edith asked how she could become my girlfriend. She said, "Is there a process involved?" Julian messaged from London about Hong Kong politics. He knew more than I did. He asked if I'd heard that the High Court had upheld a gay civil servant's spousal benefits. It might go to the Court of Appeal, but was watershed stuff all the same. An Aussie at his bank was out, but no locals he knew. Maybe things would change now. During this conversation, I was especially grateful not to have to keep my face arranged. I asked how he found it back in England. He wrote,
"Mum's happy I'm here. Happier if I quit my job, but she's accepted I won't. Some people married now, which should be illegal. Don't know why anyone's proud of having found someone. Statistically likelier than not that they will, particularly if they lower their standards. And someone from Balliol is having a baby. I suppose the world needs people to have babies."
We chose what to share. Through composition, I reduced my life, burned fat, filled edges. The editing process let me veto post hoc the painful, boring, or irrelevant moments I lived through. Necessarily, Julian curated what he told me, and that too made me happy. Together, we were making something small and precise. There was one area of my life I didn't tell him about that was neither painful nor boring nor irrelevant. But I saw other grounds for excluding it. Chapter 31. Edith had me over to meet her family on the second to last day of June. "Will it not be weird?" I said. "I presume they still don't know." Edith said it was fine. They'd be much more suspicious if they thought she was hiding me from them. "Besides," she said, "it's been over a month. You can't not meet them." The fact that over a month brought Edith and me into meeting the family territory, whereas I had known Julian for months before he'd even mentioned Miles, told me all I needed to know about dating gay women versus straight men. The Zhang's apartment was in Happy Valley, a residential area at the high altitude I had come to expect from rich people's homes. The floors were treacherous with polish. There were oil paintings propped against the walls, as if the Zhangs had bought them on a whim and would get around sooner or later to hanging them. On the shelves and side tables stood plain figurines, swans, stallions, elks. Edith explained that Mr. Zhang had got from somewhere the idea that Mrs. Zhang collected porcelain. She didn't, and scolded him for never remembering, but displayed it anyway so people would see that her husband was thoughtful. Above the TV was a large framed photograph of a toddler in a gown and mortarboard, I assumed it was Edith at a ceremony for child geniuses, but she told me it was her sister at her kindergarten graduation, which everyone did, except Edith, who'd thrown up in the car and refused to go in. That evening, Mrs. Zhang took Edith to see the principal and give a rehearsed apology for her absence. Mrs. Sheck squinted and said, "Thank you, Edith, but Mrs. Zhang, this wasn't necessary." And all the way home, Mrs. Zhang said, "Wasn't necessary?" sometimes alternating with "unnecessary" for syllabic texture. We watched TV. At the ad break, Edith read out posts from her friend Audrey, a micro-influencer. Sometimes she showed her boyfriend's wallet in brunch flat lays, but never his face. That way, when she switched boyfriend, the brand endured. We wondered about the Straits. "They're like pandas," Edith said. "You pity them in the zoo, but fling the cage open and they'll stay there, chewing. You know there's nothing intrinsically radical about us both being women." "No, not intrinsically." As if to say, challenge accepted. She added that her mother would be back soon. "Don't mention the facelift," she said. Mrs. Zhang entered. I didn't mention the facelift. She'd come home from grocery shopping with their helper, Christina, who was a head shorter than them and wore a t-shirt and track shorts. Mrs. Zhang told Edith she was getting fat, then ordered the maid to make us dumplings. The china was painted with leaves and flowers. While we ate, Christina stood there refilling our water. Edith and Mrs. Zhang acted like this was normal, so I did too. That's good to know about me, I thought. It's good to know how I behave in this situation. Mrs. Zhang told us about last night's charity gala, then looked at Edith, who asked obediently if Tatler had come. "Perhaps," said Mrs. Zhang, eyes cast upwards as though Tatler's spirit hath moved her. She didn't pay me much attention. She asked what I did, and when I said I taught TEFL, she had no further questions. I was grateful. It would have embarrassed us both if she'd pretended to take an interest in someone as unsuccessful as me. Briefly, I contemplated standing up, yanking at the tablecloth, watching the silverware crash into Mrs. Zhang's lap, and yelling at her that she had no business giving Edith complexes. But it wasn't my place. After dinner, Mrs. Zhang showed us her wedding photos. I could see the resemblance to Edith more clearly in them, either because their ages were similar or because Mrs. Zhang's face was as yet unmarked by surgical intervention. Mr. Zhang was handsome and wore thick 80s glasses. The couple looked favoured by destiny, like the subjects of a glossy history book picture taken before they were famous. Mr. Zhang was in Shanghai for the day. Edith said I'd meet him soon, and her sister Gabrielle, and her brother Angus when he was back from New York, and her grandparents at some point, of course. And then I'd have met the Zhangs. The following evening, Edith and I went to see Vampire Cleanup Department at the Patterson Street Cinema. The plot followed Tim Cheung, a Hong Kong student who became an orphan when his parents got bitten on an anti-vampire mission. As Edith said, it fulfilled the functions of a B-movie, and if you expected anything else, then you'd miss the point. The light from the theatre screen blinked against her profile. Her lips were slightly open, and her neck was long and pale, like the filament of an orchid. I nearly reached out to touch her face, but she looked so still in that suspended moment that I didn't want her to flinch. I mouthed, "You're so beautiful." Then, "I love you." Edith broke her pose to chuckle when a character swallowed the protagonist's iPhone. I laughed too. Our eyes met, and we couldn't stop. Someone coughed pointedly from several rows down, which only set us off again. She covered her mouth with her hands. She did that when she found something genuinely funny, but didn't when she was only laughing to be polite. I liked knowing that about her. It was 2 a.m. when we left. Neither of us needed to state aloud that we'd walk instead of getting a taxi, so we could discuss things privately in the night air. "Thanks for, you know, Mrs. Zhang," Edith said. "What?" "For how you handled that."
"What did she do?"
"Just her, in general. She's so rude to Christina, and I act normal about it, like that'll make it less awkward. But it's not about social graces anyway. There's no way of treating her that would make her working conditions okay.
Aren't working conditions part of how you treat someone? I said. That's why I hate Benny. It's not that he doesn't ask nicely. It's that he's not really asking.
True. We turned right on Yi Wo Street, past cut-price perfumes and medicine shops. Four bovine Australian men trudged abreast in front of us. We silently agreed to weave around the blockade. One of them whistled at Edith. She glided ahead like she was declining him admission to the category of people she was willing to notice. Sometimes I imagine the conversation where I come out to Mrs. Zhang, Edith said. When I can't get to sleep at night, I go through the script. Like much of Edith's phrasing, this sounded slightly rehearsed, and I wondered if I gave her that same feeling of needing to prepare. I wanted to tell her she didn't need to, but felt this would only make her more self-conscious. On another level, I liked that I could embarrass someone as flawless as Edith. I could hurt her. I didn't want to, but I could. I didn't need to know how other women went about being together. I could see it forever for us, walking through cities, laughing at things that weren't that funny. A few meters down from the Shanghai Commercial Bank was a Yun Fat pawn shop. It was part of a chain. I'd seen another in Wan Chai. There were no windows, but you could see blurred colors through the frosted glass door. At the top of Pennington Street, we crossed the China Congregational Church and a dwarfing Armani billboard. We waited at the lights, then marched forward with the crowd onto Leighton Road. Edith strode with such command that I stayed a step behind to watch her movements. She wore red suede point-toe flats. In a more private setting, I'd have heard them against the cement. Chapter 32. July. Dad was visiting his sister's family in New York. Mam said he sent his love. I found that strange, because it wasn't like his being in the US was suddenly depriving me of his company. New York was probably closer to me than Dublin, if anything. While Mam talked, I messaged my girlfriend, Edith, whom I was going out with. Sorry for not calling last night, I said. I was having dinner with a friend. Which friend? Mam said. You don't know her. Mam's assumption that she'd already be acquainted with any friend of mine had started in junior infants and seemingly endured after I'd moved continent. What's her name? Mam said. Edith. Would she be from Hong Kong? Because Edith was one of the few Hong Kong people I'd mentioned, Mam was disproportionately curious about her. I avoided revealing that Edith was a lawyer for much the same reason I'd regretted mentioning that Julian was a banker. Since I hadn't told Mam Edith was my friend when we were friends, and had now called her my friend when we were girlfriends, I would probably announce her as my girlfriend only when we got married. I regretted letting myself think that far. Ava? Sorry, what? Mam told me off for daydreaming and repeated that Tom had started an internship at a bank. Good on him, I said. He's a smart boy, Ava. As if that had anything to do with it. Your father's proud of him. And George misses you. This appended as if it flowed naturally from what had come before. He doesn't say so, but that'd be him. Keeps everything bottled up. Your dad would be the same. It'd mean the world to them if you'd come back to visit. Mam didn't ask for things on her own account. I'll think about it, I said. I knew I owed them a week back, but I wanted to wait until Julian returned. One of us needed to stay in Hong Kong to anchor our connection. The apartment was nautically high up, closer to the sky's amassed water than to anywhere roots grew, and it needed steady witnessing. If I left, everything between us would drift. Worse, it would remain, but I wouldn't see it. The Edith one, said Mam. She's welcome to come and stay with us. That would be a spectacle. Edith's spindly legs dangling off the couch. Edith dressing before anyone was up so we wouldn't be embarrassed by the sight of her in her pyjamas. The Edith one. But she'd said before that she didn't do well in cold weather and that her stint at Cambridge had been a spiritual test. A very expensive spiritual test, she'd said. Thanks, I told Mam. I'll pass it on. Listen, I need to go soon.
Tom's here. Will I put him on?
When she did, he sounded tired.
How's things?
He said. Grant, Mam says you're a banker now.
Fuck off. It's just Bank of Ireland.
What do you do?
Piss all. But then I stay late, so it looks like I've been working.
That's FaceTime for you, I said in a tone implying I'd come across the term in my natural environment and hadn't just learned it from Julian. Hope it gets better. There was a girl at work, Tom told me, but it wasn't a thing yet. They were still seeing. I didn't ask what they were still seeing about. He inquired about Julian with a degree of skepticism I found brazen in a younger sibling. I told him about Edith, not that she was my girlfriend, but that she was an important person in my life, and I'd like him to meet her. He said she sounded nicer than Julian. I miss you, I said. I need to go now.
Yeah, sure. Keep me posted on Edith.
Sometimes the children had questions about my life. The younger ones wanted to know if I slept in the school and if Ireland was the same as England. Julian's banker friends had often seemed just as confused on this point. The older ones asked if I had children of my own. I found this question horrifying, but knew that around 10% of my salary was for projecting a nurturing aura, so I just smiled and said no. When they asked about men, I remembered that many of their parents would not want me teaching them if they knew about Edith. Probably some of them were old enough that they themselves would not want me as a teacher. I wouldn't want me as a teacher either, but not because I had a girlfriend. Chapter 33. Edith turned 23 on the 5th of July. I used Julian's card to buy her a pair of quilted leather gloves. I wrote claiming they were for me and asked whether I should get them in black or cognac. He replied,
I can't believe you think I'd have an opinion on this.
Then, 5 minutes later,
cognac.
That night, Edith took me along to a group dinner on Connacht Road. Her friends were all our age and mostly women. Cyril Kwok and Tony Eng arrived together and gave Edith a joint present. She'd mentioned before that some Hong Kong parents were more liberal than hers. I wondered if anyone there knew that she and I were dating. The restaurant had exposed red brickwork and clipboarded menus that called every item artisan, percolated, or deconstructed. They'd got the headcount wrong. Edith arranged for another table to be gerrymandered over to the end of ours, then through brisk intimation showed each of us where to sit. She was a spry conversationalist and used tailored strategies for drawing everyone out. Whatever I said, I felt people were only listening because I was responding to a question Edith had asked. She poured everyone water. You got a man first, I told Tony. Edith had put me beside him.
Men are easy, he said. Women are hard.
I thought I saw him smile. The food came on slates, with condiments in clay espresso cups. Many of the faces were familiar from Edith's Instagram, which I could tell her later, but still, obviously, had to hide from the people themselves. They were all Hong Kongers. Most had been at boarding school with Edith and had stayed in the UK for university, while others had gone to the US or returned home. They had the kind of brisk English accents that made my mother nervous. Tony and I got talking to Clara, who taught yoga at a studio near the International Financial Centre. It was a good location. The bankers paid a premium for convenience, and if anyone was understocked on the Zen front, it was Hong Kong financiers.
Ava, Tony said, does it weird you out doing the neo-colonial Tefl thing?
Yes, I said. But no one else will hire me.
I'll find you something, he said.
I shared Edith's assessment of Tony's proficiency at pretending not to be rich. There's nothing for me here, I said. I'm a pointless white person.
You're all pointless, Tony said amicably. But I like you.
I excused myself after dessert when they ordered more drinks. I worried it might hurt Edith, but decided it would embarrass her more if I stayed and didn't contribute to discussions, which all seemed to come back to people everyone else knew and I didn't. I'd just gone to bed when she called, saying she needed me to come and pay the bill.
What?
I said. At the restaurant?
No, TST. We went drinking. I left my cards at home because I thought if I took out 500, I'd only spend 500.
How much is it?
I told you I went drinking, and Holly can only pay half.
Edith, I said, where are you? How much is it?
This bar in LKF.
You said you were in TST.
LKF?
Which bar?
I'll show you on maps.
That won't work, Edith, because I'm not there beside you.
I'll send a screenshot.
The bar was at the top of D'Aguilar Street. I took Julian's card, grateful he hadn't specified whose folly it was meant to cover. When I reached Edith, the friend had bailed too, having left enough money to pay half the bill. I felt she probably could have covered the whole thing and hoped someone would make her leave her bed unnecessarily in the near future. Edith's curls were flat. One of her dress straps had slipped. It was the drunkest I'd seen her in 4 months of knowing her. On the walls, neon lights spelled out sound bites in uppercase. The child is the father of man. Silence is more musical than any song. Edith saw the name on the Amex and told me to tell Julian she said thanks.
He doesn't need to know, I said. I'll say I was out with a male friend and he thought it meant something it didn't, so I paid for the drinks to clear it up.
Or you can just tell him.
No need.
Does Julian mind when you take his money? She seemed unconcerned that this might be a precocious question coming from someone who couldn't currently support their own head without the aid of both hands.
I mean, she said, you're just flatmates.
Actually, he's worried I'm not interested enough in it. This wasn't necessarily something I'd observed in him, but could plausibly have been true and was interesting to narrate to a third party. He doesn't want anyone to like him just for him, I said. He wouldn't know what to do with the information. I wondered why I'd said that. I wasn't drunk. We hailed a cab. Edith tried to talk to the driver, who ignored her Cantonese.
Mainlander, she said, rolling her eyes, and she negotiated our journey up mid-levels in what I assumed was Mandarin.
I was afraid to ask if she considered her father a different kind of mainlander. Outside Julian's apartment block, Edith removed her heels and asked if I could take one for her. I wasn't sure how she could carry a single heel, but not two, but felt it would be unproductive to question this. The complex was virtually empty. Edith complained that the cement hurt her feet, so we rested for a while on a stretch of grass in the courtyard.
It's not fair, Edith said. I love you so much and you don't want to stay in Hong Kong.
I do. I'm always telling you I like it here.
And I always say everything first. I asked if you'd be my girlfriend a couple of weeks back, and now I said I love you first, and you didn't even acknowledge it.
Thanks, Edith. Thanks for saying I love you. I love you too. And I meant it. This surprised me. I could never have been seeing someone for so short a time in Dublin and sincerely say I loved them. But there was room to feel it here.
Good,
Edith said.
How often do you get this drunk?
You're obsessed with Julian, she said.
I'd had that exact thought before, in those precise words, and wondered if I'd ever told her. I said nothing.
You're always asking what he'd think of everything, she continued. You clearly have no interest in arranging things, so it wouldn't be a problem if he stopped paying your rent. Which, why would he do that? He sounds like a rich freak. And you know he'll get bored of you sooner or later because rich freaks are themselves boring people. There's only their money that's depraved.
She spoke quickly and without looking at me very much, like she had said all this to herself before in front of a mirror.
And he gives you money. Why? Who leaves literally an Amex for their flatmate? And why would he tell you not to have people around? I don't think you're interested in having a nice life, which is arrogant, really, because you expect other people to help you maintain an existence that you yourself can't work up any enthusiasm over. Don't take this personally, by the way. I'm just observing.
You're hammered, I said.
I do love you, though. My family are disappointed in me. They try to hide it, but I can tell.
Up in the apartment, I made Edith brush her teeth. She said she wanted to wear a bathrobe. Mine was in the wash, so I loaned her Julian's, which hung like a ball gown on her 5-foot frame. A bluish bruise was surfacing on her thigh. She thanked me for paying her bill. I said I actually quite liked the idea of Julian seeing the tab and thinking I was having fun without him. Then Edith said she loved me again, and I repeated it back to her, thinking about how some people were squeamish about wearing others' dressing gowns, but to some it was just like borrowing a coat. We sat on the couch and she leaned on me. "Your family aren't disappointed in you," I said. "No one's disappointed in you. You're an incredible person."
"Thank you," she said.
I had no authority to say that about her family. I'd only met Mrs. Zhang and didn't know what their internal dynamic was like. Still, Edith looked pleased. She nestled closer into me. I felt like abandoning everything else I did to try to be happy and just spending the rest of my life finding things Edith needed to be told and telling her. Chapter 34. Next day at work, I had a cough that cut off all my sentences. Joan gave me a mint green face mask. I said I didn't need one, and she told me that if parents saw me coughing without it, they'd worry I'd infect their kid. At lunch, I googled and discovered the mask was likelier, if anything, to breed germs by trapping hot air. This WebMD lore did not interest Joan.
"Wear the mask," she said.
I considered asking for sick leave since I was sick, but could tell she was in no mood for my funny jokes. The 12-year-olds were on the perfect aspect, God love them. They had just got to grips with the past tense, and the continuous would be next, if they survived. Present perfect, if it's continued up until now, e.g., they've been together. Present perfect continuous, if it's been continuing, e.g., they've been fucking. Past perfect if it, A, continued up to a time in the past, e.g., they had been living together, or B, was important in the past, e.g., I had thought I loved him until I met her. There was more, but my windpipe filibustered it. Eunice Fong said, "Miss, are you sick?" I wasn't sure if I was allowed to say yes. Dublin had its own take on the perfect aspect. I didn't know what to call it, but when you were after doing something, it meant you'd just done it, but didn't expect the hearer to know. "I've just fallen in love." We thought it might happen, and it has. "I'm after falling in love?" Look, I didn't think there was a heart in this piece of shit chess compartment either, but here we are. "Only after" was "just after," plus exasperation. "Mud on the carpet, you're only after hoovering." "Losing someone, you're only after finding." Julian and his friends were after things, meaning they sought them. They were after bonuses, after clients, always eating the dust of what they wanted. After never meant looking back on what they'd done. My sympathies were limited, given who they were, but I thought it might explain why they weren't happy people. Ollie from Melbourne had left Hong Kong without notice to avoid paying income tax. TEFL teachers often did that. His replacement, Derek, was from Limerick. At a staff meeting to welcome him, Joan helpfully informed us that we were both Irish. Madison shared that she was from Dublin, Erath County, TX.
"TX?" said Derek.
Joan said, "She's American." "It's weird how all the Irish leave Ireland," Madison said. "There's so much green. And you guys have the cutest accents. I've got this picture. Hold up, let me find it. Just chillin' with Molly Malone." She wheeled her